From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. A federal court recently ruled Florida officials broke federal law in 2012 when the state launched an effort to remove non-citizens from its voter rolls. Even though the effort was eventually stopped, a judge ruled the systematic removal of voters was too close to an important election. We'll talk with voting rights advocates who have been fighting the state of Florida in court over the voter purge, as well as other voting issues. Plus, results of a new unprecedented study about how sharks use their senses to find prey. That's coming up, but first, this news.
Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. Sharks have long since been known for their remarkable sense of smell, but would they be able to find prey without it? It turns out some species can. In an unprecedented multisensory study published this month in the science journal PLOS ONE, that's the Public Library of Science, researchers with Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota, the University of South Florida, and Boston University reveal some surprising evidence about how sharks use their senses and hunt prey. We're taking a closer look at the findings, how the research was conducted, and what its conclusions could mean for sharks' survivability in a changing environment. Joining me now is lead author of the study, Dr. Jane Gardner. She's a postdoctoral fellow with Moat Marine Laboratory's Sensory Biology and Behavioral Program. Dr. Gardner, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Good morning.
And I invite our listeners to join the conversation as well. If you have a comment or question, phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or connect with us via Facebook at WGCU Public Media. And as I mentioned, Dr. Gardner, sharks have long since been known for their sense of smell as their primary sense tool when it comes to finding prey. But did your research findings suggest that that's really not the whole picture?
Absolutely. We certainly have had these ideas about smell in these animals for a long time, and this is both the public and scientists alike. Some of the earliest behavioral work that was done on sharks really focused on the sense of smell and really suggested that that was a very important sensory modality for them. And that was one of the most surprising findings coming out of this study, was that that doesn't really seem to be true across all species. So we took a look at three different species that are found here in our Florida waters, the nurse shark, the bonnethead, and the black-tipped shark. And we found that while smell is very important for the nurse shark, it seems to be less important for the bonnethead and the black-tip. They do appear to be able to identify their prey visually as well as by smell. So if they were perhaps approaching prey from upstream and those odor cues were not available to them, they would be able to recognize their prey using vision and still be able to locate it and capture it.
Give us a little more background on these, the three different species of sharks that you mentioned that were part of this report. Why did you choose these three?
We were aiming to have three different species that are found in slightly different environments, that hunt a little bit differently, and that capture prey in different ways and different types of prey as well. So we chose the nurse shark, which is a benthic shark, meaning that it's a bottom-dwelling shark. They're typically a nocturnally hunting animal, so if some of the listeners have seen them in our Florida waters, they're quite common around the Keys. And you may see them when you're snorkeling, and often during the daytime you'll find them kind of resting on bottom under a coral head. They tend to be more active at night, and that's mostly when they've been recorded hunting. And they do approach their prey slowly. And once they get very close, they open the mouth very rapidly to generate suction, which draws the prey in. So they'll actually pull fish from hiding places at night on the reef, sometimes down inside of crevices and so forth. And they're doing this primarily by suction. They feed mostly on fish. The bonnethead is the smallest member of the hammerhead family. They do come from slightly different environments, but they were also quite interesting to us because there's, of course, that unusual head shape in this family of sharks. Mm-hmm. It's wider than what you see on most typical sharks, which we kind of call our pointed-nosed sharks. And there have been all kinds of theories put forth as to why they may have evolved this unusual head shape, and most of those relate to potential sensory enhancements that might be associated with that. So they were a really interesting one to look at. But in addition to that, they're also found in a slightly different environment. They're a daytime hunter that you would typically see around Florida over seagrass beds, so in shallow waters, but cruising sort of just up off the bottom. And they're generally looking for crustaceans around here. Sort of our area of Florida, they're primarily hunting for swimming crabs and shrimp. And down in the Keys, they're kind of known for taking spiny lobsters. And for the bonnethead, they're going to actually locate their prey from a little bit further out. They need room to actually accelerate and get up to speed, because what they're going to do in capturing is use what's called a ram capture, which means that they're going to overtake their food with the mouth open and then overtake the food that way and capture it. The black-tip shark is, of course, a much faster-moving animal. They're very popular here in the recreational fishery. They're actually our number one shark, recreational shark, here in Florida. So they're probably familiar to a number of listeners that are, if they're an avid fisherman around here. And these guys are cruising midwater. They swim very rapidly, and they chase down fish. And they're typically doing this during the daytime. And they are going to, like the bonnethead, be accelerating and then overtaking their food with the mouth open. So slightly different environments for each one, slightly different ways of capturing their food, and then slightly different prey in most cases as well.
Okay. And when we're talking about shark senses, I think multisensory, when we're talking about vision or smell, we all kind of know what we're talking about. But what do we mean by terms lateral line and electroreception?
Right. So these are senses that are a little bit less familiar to us as humans, because we really don't have anything that's equivalent to that. The lateral line system is made up of these little hair cells, which are very much like the hair cells that you have in your inner ear and that all vertebrates have in their inner ear. And they function based on mechanical cues. In our inner ear, that's based on sound waves. And in the lateral line system of a fish, that's actually based on water motion in the environment. So we sometimes term the sense that they're mediating distant touch, but what they're really picking up on is water movement. And this can be large-scale water movement from currents, for example, or it can be small-scale, like the wake that's left behind from the tail beats of a fish that they might be interested in eating. The electrosensory system is detecting very weak electric signals in the environment. I often compare it to those 9-volt batteries that are common in our smoke detectors at home. So that's 9 volts. It's in one of those square batteries. The shark's electrosensory system is sensitive to less than a nanovolt of an electric field. And where you're going to find fields that are that weak are around things that are alive in the water. So it's coming from the muscle contractions from the heartbeat and also from the breathing movements of those fish. And that's going to help them when they're at a really close range. It's going to be, like I said, a very short-range sensory system over maybe a distance of about a half a meter or so that they're going to be able to pick up on that.
So I would imagine if you're testing, the use or dependence on lateral line, you know, you don't just have these sharks in a stagnant pool somewhere. You've actually got water moving. Tell us how the study itself was designed.
Well, it was designed to be conducted in a flow tank where we had control over the direction and the speed of the flow. Stagnant water is actually very, very uncommon because even if you don't have any kind of a source of water coming in or coming out of a small pool, for example, as soon as a fish starts moving, they're actually generating their own flow from their own tail beats. So it's not a very natural situation to look at an animal in a really stagnant environment. And flow does play a big component, just like it does in air. And hunters always have a great concept of this. You never want to be upwind of something that you're trying to hunt, because they will smell your scent. In the same way, water is going to carry odors that are coming from a prey item, will carry those odors downstream to a shark that could be picking up perhaps on the odor cue. So the tank was designed to control that flow so that we could control the types of signals that we were giving to our sharks. It's basically a long channel. It's about an 8-meter long working area. And at the downstream end, we have a pen where we can confine an animal behind a gate. And set up a live prey item at the upstream end, wait for that odor plume to be carried down to the waiting shark, and then we can open the gate, release the shark, and track its movements using cameras. And we had cameras both above the tank to look at their general swimming motions and a high-speed camera that was positioned next to a window in the side of the tank that was in the area where the prey was located so that we could record any bites that happened, because these bites are very, very fast in these animals.
And you know, when you're looking to temporarily disrupt or compromise a sense, how on earth do you go about doing that? How do you block a shark's vision temporarily, or sense of smell,
yeah,
for that matter?
That was one of the biggest challenges of this project, actually, was coming up with ways of doing this. Kind of the old school way of eliminating vision in a fish actually just involved removing the eyes themselves, and that's not something we wanted to do. We wanted to be able to minimize the number of animals that we took from the wild for this study. Of course, we're always concerned with numbers when we're talking about sharks, because so many of the populations are in pretty rapid decline. So we wanted to make sure that we kind of maximized the use of every animal that we had here in captivity. So we wanted to be able to use them in sort of multiple test situations. So rather than remove the eyes, we simply covered them. And so we were able to kind of put these, they're almost like an eye patch of a heavy black plastic material that we were able to cover the eyes with, and those could easily be applied and then later removed if we wanted to be able to look at an animal with vision again.
And what about sense of smell? How would you temporarily block that?
So we actually used a nose plug, and this was made just out of a small piece of cotton soaked in Vaseline. The Vaseline is actually inhibiting water from getting into the olfactory cavity, and the water is, of course, carrying the odor, so that's going to prevent any odor from getting to their smell receptors.
Sounds simple enough there, then. We're exploring results of a newly published multisensory study on how sharks use their senses. We're speaking with the study's lead author, Dr. Jane Gardner, with Moat Marine Laboratory. You can connect with Dr. Gardner by calling 877-GCU-TALK. Post your comments or questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media, or send email to Gulf Coast Live. And let's talk a bit about the results of the research. What did you discover about shark senses and the animal's ability to adapt when one or more senses is compromised?
This was the other really surprising part of the study. Of course, different senses come into play at different distances from the target, which in this case we're talking about a prey item. Smell is often the first cue that they can pick up on. It can be carried quite a distance by flowing water. As they're tracking that trail of odors, they're using both smell as well as their lateral line system. When they get closer, they can see the prey. When they get even closer than that, they can sense any movements from it with their lateral line system. And then at the closest range, they're able to pick up on the electric field around that prey item. So we did expect to some degree kind of a logical progression through these different sensory cues. But the really surprising part was that in many cases, these animals can actually switch from their preferred cue to an alternate cue and still accomplish the behavior, which was really quite impressive. So the black-tip shark, for example, as I mentioned, this is an animal that needs to pinpoint its prey from a distance to have room to be able to accelerate so that it can overtake the fish and be able to capture it. And so typically they use vision to do this. That gives them that precise location on their prey item from a distance of a few meters, giving them plenty of room to get up to speed. But if they are operating without vision, they can actually still detect their prey and capture them. But they're going to have to get much closer and use the lateral line. So it results in a slower strike, but in about a 60% success rate, which is quite impressive.
Wow. So each of these animals kind of has their own unique, succession of how they use their senses throughout, the multi-steps of actually finding and then catching prey.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And, as you said, surprisingly, they're able to adapt and change that when their preferred method is compromised, in this case with the research temporarily. Is this, would you say, positive news in terms of their adaptability and their survivability in a changing environment?
It would suggest that in some cases they may be better kind of situated to kind of overcome some of the challenges that we as humans have created for them. Of course, the biggest challenge is simply overfishing, and having this kind of adaptability is not really going to help them there. But if we're talking about some of the environmental changes that we've introduced, there are a number of pollutants in our waterways that are pretty tough on the sensory systems, things like oil as well as the dispersants that we use to break up oil, are quite toxic to the olfactory system. A number of heavy metals, as well as antibiotics, are quite toxic to the lateral line system. So just a couple of examples of things that cause direct damage to the actual receptors. And then, of course, we have other types of changes that we've introduced in a lot of environments. The water is quite turbid, so lots of sediment stirred up off the bottom from various human activities. We also have things like runoff that have resulted in some large algal blooms, and those tend to block out a lot of light. So both of those situations can dramatically reduce the visual environment for these animals. So an animal that's adapted to be able to hunt both with and without vision, for example, could still possibly be successful in an environment like that. An animal that's not capable of switching away from those visual cues is going to have a tough time feeding in an environment where the visibility is dramatically reduced.
We're exploring the results of some newly published multisensory research on how sharks hunt and find prey with the study's lead author, Dr. Jane Gardner. This is WGCU. And just a moment ago, Dr. Gardner, you mentioned, some of these changes in the environment, things like algal blooms, which, of course, have been a problem along southwest Florida's coast, and, of course, the oil spill and the dispersant, bringing to mind the 2010 oil spill. Has MOAT been looking into how sharks have been impacted or maybe continue to be impacted by the environmental damage caused by the BP spill in 2010?
We were involved in some monitoring activities there, trying to look at numbers of sharks. And I'm not sure if we have any final data on that just yet, but that's something we're certainly working on, looking at whether or not animals, some of our larger pelagic sharks, had been in contact with the oil and what some of those impacts may have been on various body systems, such as the reproductive system in particular.
And I read this study could be used to inspire new designs for underwater robotics. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. So, we're often interested in having vehicles, underwater vehicles, for example, that can be sent in towards a particular target, whether you were possibly trying to track maybe a source of a chemical leak, for example.
Something like Waldo.
Something like that, or absolutely, Waldo is one that's tracking algal blooms, and a lot of times those are based on sensing chemical cues. And as part of another study that was published under sort of the same overall umbrella, we looked at how timing really mattered in terms of the arrival of those chemical cues, rather than just the concentration information. And now we're kind of able to take that one step further and look beyond just the chemical cue itself, but look at also how flow cues are important, how at closer range you may be able to use some of the visual or hydrodynamic cues, or possibly even electrical cues. So we're kind of hopeful that the folks that are designing these types of things may be able to look at these general algorithms for how to kind of track and arrive at a particular target, and may be able to improve the design of underwater vehicles using that information.
Okay. And can we expect you or other researchers at MOAC to sort of piggyback on this research, and maybe we could see future multisensory studies with different shark species?
Absolutely. So that's one direction that we could go in, would be to look at additional species that are hunting on some very different prey items. Of course, there are a wide variety of sharks and also rays and skates that have all of these same sensory modalities that we've looked at in this study that are from even broader environments and hunting on, again, some very different prey types. But currently what we've actually been doing is taking a look at a different behavior and taking a multimodal approach to that. And what we've been interested in is navigation and homing behavior. So it's probably better known, homing behavior is probably better known in other species like sea turtles and salmon that are performing these very large migrations to go back to the areas where they were born. But there's sort of mounting evidence at this point that it's very common in sharks as well, that they're honing in at least regionally and sometimes down to the very fine scale back to the areas where they were born when they're ready to reproduce. And we would really like to know how it is that they're doing that, and what sensory cues they're using, both over the very broad scale to get from one side of the ocean to the other, and then over the very fine scale to pinpoint the very precise location.
Wow, very interesting. I didn't realize it was that fine-tuned, kind of similar to the way it is with sea turtles.
Absolutely.
Tell us also, just lastly, we got a couple minutes left. I was very interested in your experience doing research with whale sharks. You actually got to swim with whale sharks last summer around Mexico?
It's actually been a few years ago that we did this work. There was a paper that we put out in 2010, and it was a really wonderful study, a really great example of the neat things that you can accomplish when you bring together folks from sort of a variety of different fields. And we really took a broad-scale look at what these animals are doing when they're feeding. So we went to Mexico. There's a very large aggregation of whale sharks there during the summer months, and they're feeding on plankton. And so we took a look at what types of plankton were in the environment, what the densities of plankton were, and what the caloric content of that plankton was. From there, we looked at how fast these animals were swimming. We looked at how much water flow, modeled the water flow through the mouth and through their filter pads. They've got these wonderful large filter pads inside the pharynx that are allowing them to filter out these tiny plankton particles that they're feeding on. And then we also use satellite tags to track their movements to look at how much time they spent at the surface feeding. They tend to be feeding in the morning. They tend to take a little break when the sun is sort of highest in the sky and it's very, very hot. And then they tend to come back up in the afternoon and feed again. And so combining all of that information together, we were able to model not only how the water moves through the mouth and how it is that they're filtering out these little particles, but also looking at how much energy they're acquiring while they're performing these activities on a daily basis.
Well, that is all the time we have for today's show, but I want to thank my guest, biologist Dr. Jane Gardner. She's a postdoctoral fellow with Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota. She's also lead author of the newly published study we've been discussing this morning on shark senses. The study was published in the Public Library of Science Journal Plus One. Dr. Gardner, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
There's more information on today's show, as well as an archive of past shows at our website, wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. You can also find a link to the study we've been discussing there. To comment on anything you've heard on this or any edition of the program, email us, gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Thanks to my producers, Luke Martin and Richard Chinqui. Also thanks to host Ashley Lopez. This is WGCU, Fort Myers 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.